Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and thanks for downloading this week's show. My guest is Pat Mills, writer-director of the new comedy Guidance, which opens in Toronto this Friday, August 14th. He's also the star of the film, playing a former child actor who cons his way into a job as a high school guidance counselor, for which he is entirely and almost disastrously unqualified. Pat picked Mike Nichols' 1988 farce Working Girl, the film that made Melanie Griffith a proper movie star, reminded people Harrison Ford can be funny, and should have nabbed Sigourney Weaver an Oscar. It's a rags-to-riches comedy about a Staten Island secretary who seizes a chance to barge into the Wall Street elite, makes herself over into a serious businesswoman, and lands the executive of her dreams. And as Pat is about to explain, it has more than a little in common with Guidance than you might think. This is someone else's movie. The other thing I was going to say, and you've heard me say this, I'm sure, on the show already, is that every single person picks something I wouldn't have expected.
Right.
So, why? What brought you to Working Girl? Or what made you decide you wanted to talk about Working Girl for this length of time?
I was thinking about that, and I never watched it when it was in the theater. I think I was too young. But when I was in high school, it played on City TV, like late great movies.
Yeah.
And I taped it, and I kind of became obsessed with it during high school. And I was trying to think of why, when I was asked to do this show, and I think it was the first time I felt like I could relate to a protagonist in a movie, because I didn't have any friends in high school, and I felt like I totally didn't fit in, and I think there was something about Tess McGill with her big hair and her Reeboks trying to climb the ladder in, business in New York that I could relate to. And I've also been obsessed with Sigourney Weaver ever since seeing this movie. So it's kind of like, and it's something that I always come back to when I'm writing a script. I feel like every filmmaker has that movie that they're unintentionally or unconsciously ripping off.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like structurally, Working Girl is the perfect movie. So I always kind of go back to it, or I always find myself going back to it when I'm writing something, and I can kind of see oh yeah, that's what happened to Working Girl, or at this moment, this happens that's similar to what happens in Working Girl. So it's kind of, I actually think that it's the perfect Hollywood movie. And it also is feel good. And it made me feel, whenever I'd feel blue in high school, I would watch it.
Okay.
And there's something with the uplifting Carly Simon music and everything that made me feel like everything was going to be okay.
It's a really weird, I was trying to figure out where it fit in the sort of continuum of studio mentality pictures, because it's obviously Wall Street and Secret of My Success had already existed and sort of rolled into this. But what makes it work on a populist level is that there is no ambiguity about anybody's intentions. You know,
right?
The jerks are jerks.
The good jerks
people are good
jerks.
People. And it plays that way. It plays like a fairy tale where we can clearly root for Tess, who's the big haired underdog.
Yeah.
Over Catherine, the kind of prickly monster.
Yeah.
But there's also the thing that Mike Nichols does, which is make the bad guys human. Like, they're jerks, but they're not monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's, the thing I love about Weaver so much in this film is how that one little moment where she's composing the letter to her grandparents and on the exercise bike.
Oh, yeah.
Dear Momo and Ba. That says everything about
Thank
who that person is.
Thank you for the knickknacks.
Yeah. And it's like that weird patrician relationship, and all of it is in there. And I just know that that's something that, she grew up in, I believe it was New York City. She was the daughter of a broadcaster, Pat Weaver. And she's internalized so much of that she can just pull it out.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
And it's just everything about who that person is and why she's, doing things the way she does them, which is duplicitous and underhanded.
Right.
But while maintaining an air of sort of blue blood entitlement, and Griffith is the perfect opposition to that, because she would describe her now as earthy,
right,
which is offensive,
right,
but at the time in 1988, that's the representation that the mass audience wants. They perceive themselves as underdogs, and they're all like,
totally,
yeah, go Tess, get that snooty terrible person,
yeah,
and win everything you want. But something about the Carly Simon score elevates it instantly into a much bigger, broader story than the scrappy little underdog thing that's going on.
Well, the thing that I find really interesting, just going back to what you were saying about, like, the casting of Sigourney Weaver versus and Melanie Griffith, is they're, like, opposites. And the thing that I really like about the casting of Melanie Griffith, like, this is her at her prime. Like, she was born to play Tess McGill. Mm-hmm. She's unrefined. She's a little messy as an actor. She was on cocaine. She had to have a talk by Mike Nichols, I think, at one point, because she was showing up to work drunk. Jeez. But there's something about that. That Tess McGill is sort of messy and relatable. Sigourney Weaver is a pearl-wearing, high-class New York, with New York woman with, like, her own Warhol in her apartment of herself.
Yeah.
So there's something really relatable about, obviously, about Melanie Griffith, because we can all relate to her because she's so, like, her performance is a little, like, scrappy, mm-hmm. and I think it's because she's hungover a lot of the time. But there's something about it that makes it more real. And I watch it more, like, you notice these things that about Melanie Griffith that you don't really see in actors anymore. So she's rail thin, but she also has a little bit of a, like, a double chin.
It's kind of a baby fat thing.
Yeah, it's a baby fat thing, or a partying too much baby fat on her face. But at the same point, it's like, oh, I really like that because we can relate to that. And she's not that perfect actor that, you know, that if they were going to do this... now, like, if they were going to remake Working Girl, you know, somebody really, like, perfect would play Tess McGill.
Yeah.
And
I can't even think of someone who would do it.
Who could do it well. I know.
There must be somebody, but...
And...
Alison Brie could do it.
Oh, she'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, but I also have this default of Alison Brie can do anything, so...
She's good. She's great.
Yeah. But, you know, you're right. It's a very distinctive... her physicality is really weird.
Yeah.
For that, especially for that movie, because she's next to Joan Cusack, who's sort of designed to be the exaggerated version of Tess. Like, we get Tess because we have Cusack to show us what the worst part is.
Yeah.
And Alec Baldwin, too. The young, strapping Alec Baldwin.
The cheater, the snake.
Who's just so not the Alec Baldwin type now.
Like, yeah.
It's like, even the other films he did at the time, Red October and Beetlejuice, he just doesn't even look or sound like himself. And no, as he is now, it's kind of freaky.
And it's true. Everyone is at their prime in that movie. In Working Girl, like Sigourney Weaver, Melanie Griffith, Alec Baldwin. Oh, and Kevin Spacey is randomly in it.
The little Weasley Kevin Spacey. Yeah. I have a list of people, and I just assume that at that point agents were just pushing their kids at my neighbors, like their new young blood. So you get, in addition to the trifecta of Ford, Griffith, and Weaver, you get Cusack, Baldwin, Oliver Platt, Kevin Spacey, Olympia Dukakis. And then tiny little unbilled or incidental roles with Carolyn Aaron, David Duchovny shows up at a party. Timothy Carhart is in there somewhere. Ricky Lake is a bridesmaid.
Right.
Zach Grenier, who's on Blue Bloods now, which Kevin Wade has written a number of episodes for.
Who was he in?
Oh, he's the big imposing looking guy, although he wouldn't have been at the time. I'll show you. He's kind of a beetle-browed middle-aged actor.
Was he Warren Trask?
No, that was... Philip Bosco,
who was in The Savages.
That's right.
Yeah, and I watched that again recently. I'm like, oh my god, I never connected them because he looks so much different. I'm like, oh my god, it's Warren Trask.
Yeah, for me, his signature role is always going to be the bus driver in Quick Change, who conducts himself in a clean and hygienic fashion.
Amazing.
Because that's the performance of a psychotic, which is just so great. But this goes back to Mike Nichols and casting, which is supposedly was always the thing he was most proud of, is that he could assemble actors and find the right role for them. And you know, towards the end of his career, he was just making movies with the highest echelon of people who would say, then, you know, like, oh, I'm just doing this to work with Mike Nichols. I think that was the whole Oscar push for Closer. Everyone on every talk show was saying it was just so great because they were trying to get him another Best Director award. And with Working Girl, I didn't think quite so much of it at the time when it was suddenly nominated for, I think, 6 Oscars, including Picture and Director. It doesn't feel that important, I guess, or it doesn't feel like a standard bearer.
Yeah.
But it is, as you say, it's perfectly crafted.
Yeah.
And it's calibrated to be this amazing clockwork engine of comedy and commentary. So I kind of have to hand it to them. I have to hand it to Fox for getting them that far, mm-hmm. as far as the nominations went. I suspect, I'm kind of still pissed that Sigourney Weaver didn't win for Girls in the Mist that year.
And that's the thing, it's like Sigourney Weaver was nominated twice the same year for supporting and Best Actress, and she lost both of them.
Yeah. They say that happens, that it cancels it out. Although in 92, I think it was Pacino who was nominated for both and one actor. He was up for Glengarry in a supporting role and for Scent of a Woman in the lead.
Didn't he win?
He won for Scent of a Woman, yeah. But I think that's the only time that's happened.
Interesting.
No, I'm wrong. Jessica Lange. Didn't she win for Tootsie?
She did win for Tootsie. Yeah,
and she was up for, also, she was nominated for Best Actress for Frances.
Okay.
But that was 82. And, yeah, it's just one of the, I can never keep the Oscars straight. Probably because I don't respect their choices.
Right,
for sure. But this is one of those movies where... I really enjoy it. I look back on it and it's like, oh shit, 6 Oscar nominations. How did that happen?
Right.
And I don't think it was because 88 was a particularly bad year. I think this just happened to be the machine, or not the machine, this happened to be the picture that got the most conventional studio support behind it and just rolled. Everybody likes it. It's hard to argue.
You know what?
It's
for what they set out to do, they did it perfectly. It's a really, it's a perfect Hollywood movie that it's a perfect feel good.
Yeah.
You know? And that's why I always keep on coming back to it, because it was one of those movies that I would watch over and over again, and it always made me feel good, and I never really got that from other movies, so...
Yeah. Well, the winner that year was, at the Oscars, was Rain Man, which has not really held up as well. I mean, it's not bad, but it's very actorly, and it's got a lot of slickness to it.
And
feels
the score
more...
is really funny. Hans Zimmer, I think, and it's very 80s.
Yeah. I was going to say the production is very... It's more chrome than it maybe needs to be.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's very shiny and has a lot of slate gray in it.
Yeah.
But Working Girl feels, even though, again, it's completely manufactured, it feels more realistic and natural in its exaggerations, which is one of those things that I think you come back to the acting again. You have to believe that Griffith is selling that character.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think about other films that have used her well, because I agree, I don't think she's necessarily the strongest actor.
Mm-hmm.
But in something like Nobody's Fool, the film she made with Paul Newman.
Oh, yeah.
Where she's sort of playing a wearier version of someone who's already too experienced for her own good. And with Tess, you get someone who... Well, this is the thing that kind of amazes me. There is no... a Henry Higgins figure. Like, it's basically a woman reinventing herself as a more experienced and smarter, successful professional. It's My Fair Lady, it's Pygmalion, it's all of those things. But there's no instructor. She does it herself.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, where it becomes this sort of uniquely feminist 80s vision of succeeding in business without really trying. Because she tries. She tries really hard.
Mm-hmm. She leads the whole movie. And the thing that I like about it and with Harrison Ford is he's passive the entire movie. She's taking control of the deal.
Yeah.
And he's sort of her puppet.
Yeah.
And she's breaking them into a wedding and meeting, dancing with the father of the bride to get a meeting. And he's kind of there to woo women and like to be cute.
He's the man candy.
Yeah, exactly. And you probably, I mean, I don't know every 80s movie, but you probably didn't see a lot of that back then.
No. I mean, I'm trying to think of what it does relate to, and maybe the screwball stuff, the rebirth of the screwball in the 70s, like What's Up, Doc?
Right.
Where Streisand is sort of pulling Ryan O'Neill along like a force of nature.
Right.
But Ford, especially as an actor, that's not a choice I would have expected him to make.
Yeah.
Like I know he was fond of Nichols. They were friends. They made a couple of movies together. But this is one where I think he's putting a lot more trust in his director than he often did.
Yeah.
And you see it. Like, he's game. Like, he's up for stuff.
Yeah.
As an actor in this movie, in a way that he really... like, because he had another Indiana Jones movie around the corner, and he was just coming off some other... Oh, Witness, of course. Was just a few years earlier in The Mosquito Coast. So he just, you know, he'd beaten himself against the rocks for Peter Weir.
Or
Frantic was right around the same time.
Okay, yeah.
So he'd just done all these really grim, serious parts. Witness is a romantic role, but it's still... like, he still gets shot and
totally
shoots people. And this was the one thing, kind of little bubble where it pops up and he doesn't have to punch anybody and he doesn't have to be aggressive at all. And he has that, it's the first alt-universe explanation of his scar, because there's another one like 6 months later in Last Crusade where he has a little monologue about how he tried to give himself a pierced ear and fell.
Yeah.
And it's just the first time where he starts to be, like, he reminds you what a playful actor he used to be in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, totally.
Something like the first Raiders, like the original Raiders of the Lost Ark, where he is just he is having a ball and letting us see it.
Yeah.
That kind of boiled away in his later career.
I would agree.
And it's just, I mean, even just looking at the picture of him there, he's calm and relaxed with his arms, you know, like folded. He's not angry or aggressive. He's not, you don't get the sense that he's waiting for this moment to end so he can get on with whatever else he has planned for the day.
Right.
Which is kind of a signature of his lately.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, I've said this before. He was an extremely disappointing interview. Just,
I've heard that he was really monotone and boring. Right.
He was just pissy. Like it was, I mean, admittedly, when I met him, it was the press junket for Clear and Present Danger. So, summer of 94, the Jack Ryan movie that is not the good Jack Ryan movie that he made, Patriot Games being the one that actually works.
Mm-hmm.
And he was weirdly, apparently he is fairly prickly in interviews with people. I mean, he'll immediately, he and Tommy Lee Jones kind of have the worst reputations, but I've had a decent interview with Tommy Lee Jones, so
okay.
I don't know what that says. He's not happy to be part of the process. And at that time, he was, you know, making $100 million movies on a regular basis. He could have simply removed himself, but for whatever reason, he was part of this press day. And so I think he wants to make you as uncomfortable as he is. And it just turns into this feedback loop of, and it was,
oh, I mean, God, that sounds awful.
I've had worse. He was really disappointing because I had never met him before and grew up with him, basically, as Han Solo and Indiana Jones. He was my hero. And that went badly.
That's really upsetting. I hate it when you like meet your heroes and they disappoint. Like, yeah. That's the
almost never happens.
Yeah.
The one positive to it was that it was a round table, so there were maybe 10 people in the room, and I didn't ask the stupidest question.
Okay, well that's good.
Yeah, it's a small victory. it was uncomfortable, but you get the appeal of him in Working Girl.
Oh my God,
the charisma
when he like wets his pits and then shows it to all the secretaries in the other room. We clap. I love that part.
Yeah, it's trust. Like he's willing to do stuff, and Weaver too, who was just coming off a string of really respected, serious. Even Aliens got her an Oscar nomination. She was taken seriously as an actor and sort of driving. It's the kind of role which, if played without that wink, would put back the sexual revolution by at least 5 years.
Yeah,
especially in the 80s. Like, everybody was constantly talking. And it's happening again now, which I find fascinating as someone who watched the first wave of studio-sponsored feminism, where movies are being designed to appeal to women, even though that were still being made largely by men.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're seeing them be made by women, and you're allowed to consider the gender disparity in roles, and it's part of the commentary. Like the new Mission Impossible movie finally introduces a woman who is not only the equal but of Tom Cruise, but of the entire team.
Okay.
And it's really interesting.
And so, I hear the new Bond girl, quote unquote, is like a 47-year-old woman.
It's Monica Bellucci, assuming she is the Bond girl and they don't just switch it. And, you know, a Bond girl is a type that should have gone off like when they rebooted
it. I know.
But, I mean, Ava Green is not a Bond girl in Casino Royale. She's scary. What Working Girl does is sort of this weird dance between the expectations of the culture of the 80s, which is that, okay, she can learn a lesson, but she still has to be pretty.
For sure.
And then they give you Weaver's character, who is the expected image of female beauty and empowerment, but she's the bad person. Like, making her the bad guy is really interesting because it opens up that door to talk about women undermining each other in corporate structures.
Right.
And there is no glass ceiling exactly because Catherine has already accomplished whatever it is that Tess wants to accomplish, but she's also dedicated to keeping Tess out and stealing her ideas and pushing her down. And I know we're two guys talking about this, but it's a really interesting thing to see unpacked now,
mm-hmm.
looking back almost 30 years later to see how the film handles it. And it's actually pretty graceful.
Yep. The thing I remember, so when I was in high school and obsessed with this movie, I would go to the library and like look and find old reviews from magazines, and I would read them all. And then I found Working Girl was written about in books, and there was one, I can't remember what it was called, but it was mainly talking about masculinity and femininity in Working Girl, and it was basically implying that you can be a woman in business, but you have, like you said, you have to be pretty and feminine. Mm-hmm. And this book was arguing that all of the women who are succeeding in business and all the villains are very masculine.
Right.
And they're all wearing blazers and, what's her name? Nora Dunn?
Yes, Narda? Yeah, who shows up.
Yeah, she's got her blazer on, and Catherine's sort of masculine with her blazers, and
this was the era of intense shoulder pads.
And, exactly.
And power suits, I think, was actually a real thing at the time.
In fact, in their, like, sex scene, when they're, like, taking each other's clothes off, I love that you see Tess with her, like, blouse, but you can see the see-through underneath this gigantic white shoulder pad.
Yeah. But, this is what Blu-ray has given us.
I know. Everything a little bit more clear, right?
Yeah.
But, anyway, so it's interesting that all of the good people in the movie are makeuped and big hair, right. And she has to cut it all down and look respectable to meet this, like, masculine world. Which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing. I kind of feel like the business world is pretty masculine, but I don't know what they were trying to say. I don't even know if that was a comment, but...
Yeah, I think it's the need to... I mean, it's the makeover scene, right? Like, 2 years later in Pretty Woman, there's that whole thing where, you know, she's de-whored or whatever it is, however the Gary Marshall world sees her. And again, a huge difference between what Mike Nichols did and what Gary Marshall does in making populist films is that Nichols isn't really pandering. He's letting us know that Tess is one of us, one of the audience, the assumed mainstream, by showing that she has to make some compromises to fit into this new vision. But it's not the, here's a credit card, go be pretty.
Oh, for sure.
Which is just like...
And she failed. He had to come and shop with her.
Yeah.
When they were like, it's very expensive. She comes back crying because she doesn't know how to shop.
Yeah. And again, that's, I suppose in some other way, that's a fairy tale for the Gary Marshall universe. But it's just, there's a sloppiness and a contempt for the character that isn't present here. Like, this movie really, it's on Tess's side throughout, and again, it's because, you know, why do you need, you talk fine, that stuff.
Yeah.
But she does talk fine.
What do you need speech lessons for? You talk fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, but another thing is, like, the whole makeover thing is all Tess wants it.
Exactly.
Tess makes that decision. Tess makes the decision to take the $7,000, it's not even leather dress, and put it on. And to, you know,
to have serious hair.
Serious, you need to cut it. And it's not about, it's about her choosing to try and climb a ladder, and it's not. And she's recognizing that she doesn't take she's not being taken seriously because she's got big hair. And it's unfortunate we live in a world where somebody who looks like this late 80s big haired hairspray person can't actually climb the ladder, but it's kind of the truth. Yeah. Like, no one is going to take that person seriously, unfortunately.
It's kind of weird because I was watching, of all things, Die Hard again a little while back. Released just a few months before. And the fashions are identical. Like, everybody, even Bonnie Bedelia, is wearing pretty poofy hair, and her secretary has, like, the big ruby red glasses, and everybody is in period, even though there wasn't a period at the time, but there's just gel and cocaine everywhere.
Yeah.
And
the good old days.
Yeah, right? Well, to the point where they make a joke out of it with Hart Bachner's character, with Ennis.
Is he the guy who gets killed?
Yeah,
the beard?
He's the one who, right. The slime bag, who is basically every business person except for Jack Traynor in Working Girl. Like, the same level of entitlement, although the L.A. version in Die Hard is equally... Like, they're both caricatured, but New York's version in Working Girl is much more relatable and human, because everybody understands on some level that it's basically just armor that they all wear to do this thing.
Right.
Whereas Nakatomi in Die Hard is presented as this comedic sort of exaggeration of what business is.
Yeah.
You know, just having parties all the time, and, like, we only see them for one evening, and it's Christmas, and people are screwing in the boardroom, and like, that, just that 10-minute tour at the beginning of the movie is so dense that I was kind of amazed to see all of the echoes in Working Girl. It's like, oh yeah, this is just how Hollywood thought boardrooms worked.
Yeah, for sure.
But again, Nichols humanizes everything. He lets Philip Bosco be simultaneously hostile and patrician, and also, like, empathetic and understanding, because he's not so concerned. Like, this is the cliche, right? He's so concerned with the bottom line that he doesn't see people as people, but he kind of does. Other characters don't. Spacey's character, Oliver Platt's sort of
a sleazoid pimp with a tiny little dick.
Yeah. That's how they're written off, because they are the bottom feeders in this world.
For sure.
But again, the movie's always on Tess's side. Like, we see people the way she sees them, and they get to be redeemed if they understand her.
Right.
So it's the empathy that drives the film is really... I think that's what catches me by surprise every time. It's like, oh yeah, someone has really worked on this to make people instead of stick figures. Because this could have been... I mean, I don't know if you've seen, or how recently you've seen, the other ones, Wall Street and The Secret of My Success, but...
I actually just watched The Secret of My Success recently. I'm like, whoa, this doesn't work.
Yeah, doesn't exactly. Work at all. They're amoral. They're horrible. They're all horrible people. Where to the point where, you know, Fox's character sleeps with an aunt and they have to tell us it's by marriage, but it's still cool because he gets what he wants out of it. And it's really horrible.
Yeah.
And Wall Street women are simply disposable to the point where I'm pretty sure I don't remember who the female lead was.
Yeah.
It's Daryl Hannah. But,
oh, it is Daryl Hannah.
Right. You can't even picture her.
I didn't even think she was on the poster. And then I think of it, was she or was that Legal Eagles that she was on the poster?
That was Legal Eagles, yeah.
But,
because she sort of ceases to exist because of the charisma vacuum that is Charlie Sheen and then the charisma machine that is Douglas in that film.
Right.
But Working Girl finds a way to give the... Its central triangle isn't even romantic. It's a business triangle.
Right.
And that's, I think, what makes it so interesting. It's about human relationships, even though it's about arbitrage and deals and all these things that we aren't supposed to fully understand because Tess doesn't fully understand them.
Right.
Except that she does because she's the smartest person in the room.
Right.
That was a very long... recap.
But I know what you're... back to Philip Bosco.
Mm-hmm.
So you can almost look at it like he's the Wizard of Oz, right?
Sure, yeah.
And
he's a gatekeeper, definitely.
Yeah, but he's nice, right? And so he's like this faceless guy that's really intimidating, and they have to get up all these steps to get to him, and then when they get to him, he's like a hero. And he gives her her office when she thinks that she's going to be the secretary at the end.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to think about that. I must have been conscious, because I think that when... Harrison Ford gets Chinese food after they've slept together for the first time, he whistles, "We're off to see the wizard." I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah.
So there might be some sort of Warren Trask is the Wizard of Oz and she's Dorothy, and you know, so there might be a bit of that.
That's interesting.
The Wicked Witch is Sigourney Weaver.
Sure. I mean, those are fairly
used.
Yeah, I was just like, it's not a common trope exactly, but as signifiers, they're fairly universal. Like everyone would know what they were doing.
Yeah.
If you tweak to it.
Yeah.
It's funny. I wonder.
But yeah, another thing about the casting, just to go...
Please.
Because I love Melanie Griffith in this movie, is I think that she related to being the underdog, because I think in her career she was. Like, I think the last thing that she had done where she got good reviews was Body Double, and she played a porn star.
Yeah.
And so she probably was having a really hard time being taken seriously as an actor. Her mother had a lot of success, and she was probably just getting these, like, dopey girlfriend roles that were probably really frustrating. And
she was certainly referred to often as Tippi Hedren's daughter.
Yeah.
Even in roles where it was completely irrelevant.
She just comes off as not a very bright person, but that is what makes Working Girl work, because... you understand that people aren't going to take this person very seriously because her squeaky voice and the way that she looks, but she proves everybody wrong, and that's what I loved about the movie.
Yeah. You almost have to underestimate her going in as well.
And I think that most people do.
Yeah.
I think that even, I would imagine, the industry at the time were like, oh no, she can't carry a movie. She can play a porn star. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Well, she'd also done... There's another film that nobody saw called Cherry 2000, where she's...
Oh, like, yeah, with a gun.
Bounty
right?
hunter chasing a robot. And she's okay. Like, she's... I think that's more to do with the writer-director, Steve DeJarnett, figuring out how to use her. And again, that's what Nichols does here, is that he trusts that she can be naive when she needs to be. And just, like, it's somebody who... I suspect that if it wasn't Mike Nichols making this movie, she might not have been able to land that lead, because he could say, no, but she's good. I can
make it work.
Yeah. But I think she makes it work.
Like, she does. She absolutely does. And of course she had done Something Wild, which was really amazing in, which I always forget about. I'm like, oh, right. Something Wild. Yeah. But
that's kind of actually, we were talking about screwball films where someone gets led by the hand. That's exactly what
that
is. And then it just turns really, really dark.
Yeah.
But, I love that movie.
That's
I remember
great,
I saw that at the Canada Square on opening day, I think.
Oh, wow.
And no one in the room had any, just no one had any idea how to process it. It was so great.
Right.
So she was established as not just stunt casting.
Right.
When she made this. But this was still, like, a big deal Christmas release that
for sure.
Fox put a lot of money into. And, yeah, she got an Oscar nomination out of it. She was suddenly... unfortunately, suddenly lined up for a string of really terrible movies.
Yeah, she kind of took...
Stranger Among Us and Shining Through.
And Milk Money. Yeah, she kind of took the fame that she got, so she became A-list because of it and didn't quite go down the right path with it, which is always sad when that happens.
I mean, I understand why actors take everything that's offered to them after
a
hit, because that's, you know, you may never get this window again, and suddenly you're playing... I mean, on paper, I'm sure Shining Through sounded like a good idea.
She also did The Bonfire of the Vanities, which you can't really fault any of the actors for that one. But right.
She did get a breast job.
Did you read the Devil's Candy? Candy. Yeah. I loved that book so much. Yeah.
It's a book of... like, it's weird because the film is so grotesquely consumptive, like in that it just burns through everything in the world. And the book makes you feel so good about reading it because you're not there.
Right.
Like, it's the movie where De Palma shaved his beard so he could be in the elevator in that 5-minute take with Willis.
Oh, yeah.
So he could keep directing because there was no way to keep him out of the shot. So he had to shave his beard. And it's like, well, if you think back, just don't do it that way. Don't create that complication for yourself. And it was such a big deal that he really... it's a whole paragraph. So clearly De Palma made it important when he was talking to Salomon. But it's one of those things where you're just aghast at the end of the book about how clueless everyone is about mm-hmm. what they're doing and how it just, none of this is going to work or be worth that suffering. Totally. But also, yeah, you don't go out and get a breast breast expansion while you're being packed into form-fitting. Like, it's just senseless. But again,
it's insane. It's entirely possible, though. Like, I don't know that world, but maybe, like, Brian De Palma, you're being such an asshole. Fuck you, I'm getting a boob job.
Revenge, yeah.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible. And he may have, I mean, he directed Body Double. Maybe he wasn't very friendly on that set. You never know, yeah. Right? So it's like, I, of course, would never get a boob job in the middle of a production.
Sure.
But if I were Melanie Griffith, I might, yeah, you know?
It's the rebellion that you're allowed to have.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Another Bruce Willis movie, this just made me think just that shot, that hellish shot. I think that the 12 Monkeys, mm-hmm. Apparently, they shot one take over and over and over again of a hamster running behind Bruce Willis for 12 hours, and it was one shot. Because he didn't like the way that the wheel was turning and the hamster wasn't doing a constant move or something like that.
Oh, right. That's in the documentary, right?
Factor. It's like, why are people crazy? I don't understand. It's like directors are spoiled when they have 12 hours to get one shot.
You've already kind of answered the closing question, which is, what do you, you know, have you lifted or borrowed anything from the film? There's definitely an element in Guidance of someone impersonating...
yeah,
a station above himself,
and taking somebody else's clothes and taking their role, their job,
yeah,
and then getting in trouble for it and getting caught by the end. Like, it's totally structurally what I think I totally ripped off.
Okay, but the films are, I should tell the listeners, the films are still very different.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, the other it's not just a complete photocopy. And until you picked Working Girl, I wouldn't have made the connection.
Right.
It's like, oh yeah, of course, because this beat is sort of like that, and this beat is a little similar, but. I guess that's just part of the engine, right? Like, that's a compliment to the screenplay, to the way that the comedy is structured in Working Girl, is that you can sort of riff on it and go in a completely different direction while still keeping the core values.
Absolutely.
The character you play in Guidance is certainly not in any way, I guess, applauded for his actions.
No, not at all.
Tess is the hero, and I'm not sure your guy is.
But the thing is, at the beginning, Working Girl, Tess gets punched down over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I did that with Guidance, where it's like he loses his job because he sounds gay. His sister doesn't want to support him anymore. Like, I just kind of did that. How do you make somebody who's kind of inherently unlikable, seem being rejected for things that he can't necessarily control?
Right.
And with Tess McGill, you know, she loses her job because she's sexually harassed. And she gets her boyfriend cheats on her. It's everything.
Yeah, her world is upended before she launches. I mean, yeah, I guess it's true. It sort of is her last chance at anything,
mm-hmm.
Because otherwise she'll just be consigned to the secretarial pool forever.
Yeah, and she has no other choice but to put on Sigourney Weaver's clothes.
Yeah, it's funny. It doesn't feel, and again, that's because of the way the movie is structured. But it doesn't feel like a transgression, even though. Yeah, you're lying to people constantly and stealing not just an identity, but an entire history.
Right.
The whole background, the whole life. Like, she bleeds out her own accent. She cuts her hair. She abandons who she was while becoming the better version of herself. So it's this really weird kind of, you know, Harvard, Yale, MBA thing that she's appropriating, but for the right reasons. And... yeah, in Guidance, I'm not sure I don't even know that he has reasons. I mean, he has reasons, but I don't know that they're justifiable to anyone but himself.
True. He's not trying to climb any ladder. He just needs a gig.
Right.
He needs a bit of cash, and he thinks that he can do this. But it's not, like, you know, she, like, in Working Girl, like, she understands business and plaque. Well, there's all that stuff about plaque. And she's talking with, oh, God, Lutz. Anyway.
Yeah.
I feel like I just did not answer a question. I just went on a complete rant that makes no sense to me.
No. That's fine. I mean, that's kind of the fun of this, is that, you know, the doors are open in any direction.
Mm-hmm. And then you start going down, and you're like, wait, that doesn't lead to anywhere. I'm at a dead end. What am I saying?
Yeah. So would you, if you were packaging guidance, would you even invoke Working Girl? Would it be the kind of thing that you, like, because it almost creates a false expectation.
No, I wouldn't. Music. I just think that with everything that I've ever written, I think I always follow the structure of Working Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And because I really think that it's the perfect screenplay structure to emulate. It has a really strong subplot. There's a great juicy villain.
Yeah.
It does everything that makes like a mainstream movie work. And so I always kind of come back to it and like lay over my story on top of the structure, but definitely not a reference to Working Girl in terms of its plot or story or whatnot. It's just like the way that it the story is plotted out.
Were you ever tempted to score Carly Simon in over that last shot?
Oh my God, I would love to. Only we could afford it.
Oh, maybe this will reach her and you can get her from the next picture. So, what do you have coming up now? I mean, Guidance played a TIFF a year ago almost, so...
Yeah, well, it's coming out on August 14th in Toronto, and then in New York on the 21st of August, L.A. and Seattle on the 28th.
Oh, cool.
And then probably VOD, I don't know when after that. And I'm going to be shooting my next film called Don't Talk to Irene, likely in October. We're starting to cast right now, and it's about... like a fat girl underdog in high school who wants to be a cheerleader. So it's very similar in terms of Working Girl. You'll notice it again. And there's a lot of structure in the screenplay that's very, very Working Girl that you wouldn't know until I pointed it out.
Cool. Well, this is there's a thesis in the making for somebody in film school.
Yeah.
So it's good to have that out there.
Yeah, exactly. I'm putting that out there in the world. So yeah, I'm starting to cast that on Thursday. So we're going to see. Obviously, it's going to be a hard... search to find the lead, just because unfortunately that body type doesn't really get encouraged to be actresses. But
yeah,
we're gonna hire a private investigator if a casting director doesn't work.
Fantastic. My thanks to Pat Mills, whose feature debut Guidance opens at the TIFF Bell Lightbox this Friday, August 14th in Toronto. You can find Pat on Twitter at Pat Mills, all one word. And thanks also to Angie Burns. She knows what she did. Working Girl is available on Blu-ray and DVD from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment and for rental and purchase on iTunes. It's also on Google Play, but only for purchase. That seems weird. If you do check it out, pretend that Kevin Spacey is playing the same character he plays in Glengarry Glen Ross. It's just something I do for fun. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on the internet at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, we've only got 3 at the moment, so you'd be number 4. Thanks for listening.